Hello, friends, and welcome back to Horror Story Podcast. I'm your host, Trish, and this week I was feeling super ambitious, so I'm hitting y'all with a double feature. First, I gave you the history of pet cemeteries, and now we're going to break down one of my favorite horror movies, Pet Sematary. And listen to me when I tell you guys that this is one of those horror movies that traumatized me as a kid and still makes me very uncomfortable to this day. I'm excited to cover this one, so let's jump right in. This movie came out in 1989 and was based on the 1983 novel written by Stephen King. It was directed by Mary Lambert, and I know this is gonna be so niche, but whatever. Mary Lambert also directed this other movie called The In Crowd. It was a thriller, and you can't see this, but I'm doing air quotes when I say thriller, that came out in 2000. It was literally about these rich kids at a country club where shit just gets real dark and dramatic, and no, it's not horror, but it's just one of my favorite Y2K films. I digress. Anyway, let's get into it. The film opens with footage of a pet cemetery. We see tombstones, grave markers, and hear epitaphs being read aloud. Cut to an 18-wheeler flying unnecessarily fast down the road by this house with a sold sign. Foreshadowing. We're now introduced to the Creed family. They've just moved to Maine from Chicago. The family exits the car all hopeful after they pull into the driveway of their new home. We see Dr. Lewis Creed, aka the OG McDreamy, Rachel, his wife, their children Ellie and Gage, and their very cool cat named Church, short for Winston Churchill. In all the excitement, they immediately leave poor baby Gage unattended. Again, foreshadowing. Gage starts making his way towards the dangerous road with the fast-as-fuck semis racing down it. He's saved in time, not by his parents, but by who I will refer to almost throughout the entire episode as Judd the Troublemaker, who is so wonderfully played by Fred Gwynne, aka Herman Munster, and Judge Holler in My Cousin Vinny. Pretty iconic IMDb with just these roles alone. Anyway, Judd saves Gage, and it's great to know someone's watching this child. Ellie spots a path behind the house, and Rachel asks Judd where it leads. He plays coy and tells them that it's a wonderful story for another time. Eventually, Judd does reveal to Lewis that the path leads to a pet cemetery, and that the trucks that are constantly speeding down the road in front of both of their homes is the main reason why the cemetery was built in the first place. Judd's advice to Lewis, get Church neutered, because, quote, fixed cats don't tend to wander. We briefly meet Missy, the Creed's housekeeper. She complains to Rachel about how she thought she'd always be lucky and meet and marry a doctor. How she wishes she had one around because of her insufferable and unrelenting stomach pains. McDreamy offers to assess her, but Missy just kind of brushes it off. So, Judd the Troublemaker brings them all for a lovely hike to the pet cemetery, and Rachel is just not okay with the whole situation. It's clear she can't sit with the idea of death and grief and is having a hard time watching her children face this reality. In fact, while Judd is discussing the pet cemetery, she questions why children need to learn about death at all. Judd tries to paint a prettier picture of the cemetery and its symbolism to Ellie in front of Rachel. He tells Ellie that it's a place where the dead speak through their gravestones, that it's a place of rest. That night, Ellie questions Lewis, what if Church dies and winds up in the pet cemetery? Lewis tries to explain that while he may pass, it's possible he'll live for a very long time, but he doesn't make up the rules on how long cats can live. Ellie is upset by this and starts to express anger towards God, who she assumes makes these rules. She says, he's my cat, not God's cat. Let God get his own if he wants one. Meanwhile, Rachel is in the kitchen, listening on, visibly uncomfortable. So far, when the subject presents itself, it's almost as if these conversations are as much for Rachel as they are for Ellie. Her discomfort is reinforced in the next scene when it's time for Church to visit the vet. Remember, according to Judd, the best way to prevent Church from running out in the road and getting hit by a truck is to have him neutered. Or, as Missy explained to Ellie, get his nuts cut. Ellie is nervous about Church and looks for reassurance that he'll make it out of the procedure okay. Rachel defers to Lewis and makes him promise that it'll all turn out fine. Lewis is a little resentful of the task because if something does happen to Church and he doesn't make it, which Lewis does admit is a rare occurrence, Rachel is going to have to be the one to explain it to her. And of course, then Ellie's going to be destroyed and distrusting. Next, we get to see Lewis's first day at his new job as a director of health services on the University of Maine's campus. And we also get to meet my favorite character, Victor Pascal, who is rushed to McDreamy after being, guess what, hit by a truck. Like, spoiler, but also not a spoiler, the entire movie is basically you get hit by a truck, and you get hit by a truck, and you get hit by a truck. There's a lot of chaos and commotion, and Lewis is shouting out orders for the staff to carry out, which no one does. I mean, Pascal is totally mangled. His head is busted open. It's a pretty bleak and hopeless situation, which Lewis acknowledges. The staff clears out. He's left alone with Pascal, who briefly comes to for a moment. He grabs Lewis and says, "The soil of a man's heart is stonier." He then gurgles Lewis's name, tells him he'll come to him, and passes away. That night, Pascal does come, and he tells Lewis he wants to help him like Lewis had tried to help him. But, like, I'm not sure how much anyone at the campus actually did for Pascal, but it is what it is. And I just want to make note that in this scene, Lewis is wearing scrubs as PJs, which is either a sign that his ego is beyond inflated, or he really loves his job that much. Pascal gets Lewis to follow him out of the house and leads McDreamy down the path to the pet cemetery. He reiterates what Judd said to the family, that it's the place where the dead speak. He then tells Lewis that no matter how much he feels he has to, he shouldn't go to the place where the dead walk. He points past the cemetery, further into the woods, and warns him the ground is sour. Next, we see the family, except for Lewis, getting ready to fly back home to Chicago to spend Thanksgiving with Rachel's family. Lewis opts to stay in Maine, as he apparently doesn't get along with her father. After they leave, he gets a call from Judd saying that he has a dead cat on his lawn that looks like Church. McDreamy makes his way across the road to confirm it is, in fact, Church. Judd asks Lewis what he's going to do in regards to the cat. And while Lewis is discussing his options on burying the cat and how to break the news to Ellie, Judd, the troublemaker, says, "Maybe there's a better way." The two make their way into the pet cemetery, and Lewis asks Judd where they should bury Church. But Judd has other plans. He points to where Pascal specifically told him not to go and tells Lewis that's where Church will be buried. And Judd is way too excited to bring Lewis to this forbidden spot, which is exactly how we'd expect a troublemaker to act. After what seems like miles of steep and rocky terrain, they finally reach a place that looks like this absolutely unsettling and ominous crop circle of rocks. Judd tells Lewis that this was the burial ground of the Mi'kmaq Indians. His words, not mine. Thoroughly confused and creeped out, McDreamy wants to know why he brought them there. To which Judd replies, "I have my reasons." Like, alrighty, how about elaborate? He then hands Lewis a shovel and tells him he can't help him bury the cat. Each has to bury their own. And I just love how McDreamy, like, just accepts this. No questions. No pushback. Despite any and all unsettling feelings, he totally puts his trust in Judd and just goes with it. After Church is buried, they make it back home, and Judd tells Lewis that when he talks to his family, he can't say anything about what they did. Just nonstop red flags about this situation. Lewis asks, "What did we do?" Judd, again, is kind of vague and cryptic and explains that what they did is a secret. And people wrongfully assume that women are typically better at keeping secrets, but most women have never seen into a man's heart. He emphasizes that a man's heart is stonier than the soil he buried church in. For Lewis, that line triggers a flashback of Pascal pretty much saying the same thing. The next day, much to McDreamy's disbelief, Zombie Church makes his appearance. But something about the cat is definitely off. He follows up with Judd, who finally spills the beans about the spot he took him to. He says he heard about it from a ragman who was half Mi'kmaq. And apparently, a ragman in the days of yore was someone who went around town collecting and dealing with rags, iron, old clothes, furniture, household items, etc. The ragman had told Judd about this place when his dog had gotten sick and passed away. He knew how much the dog meant to Judd. But when the dog returned home after being buried there, he was not the same pet. Judd said he took Lewis there to give Ellie more time with church, which, like, bullshit, Judd. Lewis asks if anyone ever buried a person up there. Judd is startled by this. He gets all shaky, knocks his drink over, and is like, Christ no, who the hell would do that? Like, okay. The troublemaker doth protest too much. So the Creed family returns from Chicago, and Ellie immediately questions if church is okay. She tells Lewis she had a dream that Judd and him buried the cat in the pet cemetery after he died from being struck by a car. So it's kind of interesting to note here about Ellie, this is not the last time we see her have these almost premonition-like dreams. In his stories, Stephen King often has a psychic element or some character with a kind of psychic ability. Think Carrie or The Shining. We don't know if Ellie had the shine. It's one of those themes and concepts that really isn't explored more in the film. The next scene is sad. It's Missy. We see her writing a suicide note that says she's convinced she has cancer and she cannot face the pain. She then hangs herself in her basement. Stephen King makes an appearance in the next scene as the priest presiding over the burial. Judd's there with Lewis and Ellie, but missing from the scene is Rachel. Lewis says she's at home, sick with the flu, but Ellie clues us in as to what really may be the issue. She says that she's been sick ever since she heard about Missy's suicide, again reinforcing that Rachel cannot handle death in any capacity. Judd the troublemaker asks Lewis, why does God take someone like Missy, but let someone like him continue on? Which to me it's like, you got a guilty conscience, Judd? Lewis replies that his father used to say, God sees the truth, but waits. And to me, that's almost saying, you'll get yours too. Don't worry. Just you wait. Missy's life and death are brief scenes in the film, but they have an important purpose. They're used to keep the discussion about death and the afterlife with Ellie open, as we see later on that night. Ellie approaches Lewis and asks if he thinks Missy is in heaven. Lewis doesn't shy away from the conversation. He poses a few options to her. Some believe in heaven, others believe in reincarnation, and some that you just extinguish like the flame of a candle being blown out. It's important to note that Rachel is eavesdropping in the kitchen. Again, somehow she's always part of the conversation surrounding death, even if she's just lurking on the outskirts of it. Shortly after their conversation, Rachel, dressed in an entirely different outfit for some reason, which, side note, there's clothing continuity issues during the movie, but what are you going to do? She walks into the bedroom to talk with Lewis. She admits that she was listening in on the conversation with Ellie, and that when she gets scared, she becomes defensive, which is pretty clear in her initial reaction to Judd when they're first introduced to the pet cemetery. Lewis asks her if she's afraid of dying, to which Rachel brings up her sister Zelda, who passed away when Rachel was a child of spinal meningitis. Rachel begins to share with Lewis something that she's clearly never spoken about before. She talks about how Zelda was kept in the back bedroom like a dirty secret. She opens up about how the entire family wished Zelda died. Not so Zelda would be released from the agony of her malady, but more so that the family would be released from the burden of Zelda and the pain it brought them all. She also opens up about the fact that when her parents went out, they would leave her to care for Zelda on her own. One night, Zelda had a seizure in front of Rachel, and she choked to death. Rachel was afraid that she would be blamed for Zelda dying. She says she ran screaming from the house. And when people found her, she appeared to be crying. But what she actually believed she was doing was laughing in relief. I think this story definitely sheds light on why Rachel has such a tough time with the emotions around grief and death. For Lewis, his disdain for her parents is now only reinforced, and we can assume adds to the tension between them that inevitably comes to a head later on in the film. And now we've come to the most indelible and catalyzing moment in our film. And naturally, it all begins with an 18-wheeler truck flying down the fucking road, blasting the Ramones. This ominous image is spliced with scenes of the Creeds and Judd the Troublemaker enjoying a peaceful, serene lunch outside, while Lewis and Gage fly a kite. Naturally, the family is having such an amazing time watching Gage fly the kite on his own, they just decide to stop paying attention to him altogether. You see where this is going? Gage accidentally drops the handle to the kite, and it starts to fly away. Baby Gage starts trotting after it, right in the direction of the road. Yes, the same road that our menacing rock and roll semi is barreling down. And somehow again, the only one who seems to notice is Judd, but it's too late. Lewis can't make it to him in time. The truck driver tries to brake and swerve, but it's no use. He hits Gage and flips the truck. They both obviously don't survive the accident. At what we can assume is later on that evening at the Creed home, we get Ellie's interesting perspective on Gage's death that also provides us with some foreshadowing, as well as what could be viewed as motivation and encouragement for actions Lewis carries out later on. She shows Judd a picture of Gage and says she's going to carry it with her until God lets Gage come home. Judd said that God doesn't do that, and Ellie argues that he can if he wants to, and she's going to keep Gage's things waiting for him. She's obviously and understandably struggling with the idea that her brother is 100% gone from their lives. While discussions about death were available for Ellie, a lot of it has kind of been romanticized. I think while reality had presented itself, it didn't stop anyone from encouraging her to interpret things her own way. And we can just kind of see Lewis during this sort of glazing over and shutting down. The next scene is Gage's funeral, and it is just out of control. Rachel's father, Erwin, approaches Lewis while he's at the casket and tells him how he warned Rachel about him, how their marriage would bring her nothing but grief, and how he blames him for Gage's death, calling him a killer of children. He punches Lewis, the two tussle, unfortunately knocking Gage's casket over in the process, which is just straight up trauma. When putting Ellie to bed after this whole insane ordeal at the funeral, she again plants the seed in Lewis's mind. She says, God could take it back if he wanted. Can I have faith in that? To which Lewis says, I suppose you can. Which, I don't know if we should have gone there, but part of me feels Lewis just wasn't reassuring Ellie, but validating his own ideas as well. And like clockwork, Judd the Troublemaker senses this. He senses what he's up to. He makes his way inside the Creed's home to talk to Lewis about what he knows is running through his mind, bringing Gage to the Micmac burial ground. He finally admits to Lewis that someone had tried and failed miserably to bury a human up there. Judd tells the story of a local boy named Timmy Baderman who was killed on his way back home from World War II. His father, Billy, was so grief-stricken that he decided to bury him in the Micmac ground. When Timmy returned, a local woman named Margie sensed immediately that whatever came back wasn't Timmy. It was an abomination. She called upon the men in town to handle the situation. A bunch of them, including Judd, went to the Baderman house. They decided they were going to kill zombie Timmy once and for all by lighting the house on fire with him inside. When they get there, Judd tries to warn Billy that Timmy is a monster and he needs to leave the house now. The father wants them to leave them alone. He says, he's my son. But by the time Billy realizes what's going on and that they're setting the whole damn house ablaze, it's too late. He tries to tell Zombie Timmy that they gotta go, and he wants to escape with his son, but it's no use. Timmy drags his father further into the burning house, screaming something that sounds like love, dad, hate living. Both the Baderman boys burn alive. Well, one of them's alive. Judd says that the Micmacs knew when it was time to stop using that ground because it had gone sour, that he shouldn't dare think of using it, that sometimes dead is better. We next see Rachel and Ellie at the airport heading back to Chicago with Rachel's parents. Lewis muses that maybe this will be a good thing. Maybe this is the beginning of Rachel repairing her relationship with her parents. Ellie confesses that she doesn't want to leave. She's scared. She had another premonition dream. This time, it was about Lewis, Gage, and someone named Paxcow. She's clearly referring to Pascal, but is unable to pronounce the name correctly. Lewis is like, haha, okay, and attempts to usher them on their way, but not before Rachel's dad, Irwin, apologizes to Lewis, and he extends his hand as an olive branch, to which Lewis basically gives him the dead fish handshake in return, which, I don't know, can't say that I blame him. So the family departs for Chicago, and where do we see Lewis immediately go? The cemetery to dig up Gage, when the cat's away and all. As he's sitting by Gage's grave, he gets a warning from Pascal, repeating that the ground is sour. This is a barrier that should not be crossed. Lewis rationalizes his decision by saying that if Gage comes back as Timmy Baderman did, he'll just, quote, put him back to sleep, and Rachel and Ellie will be none the wiser. He's just fully descending into madness. It cuts to Ellie, who is alarmed and crying from yet another premonition dream. Rachel tries to comfort her, but she tells her mom that Paxcow, who is literally doing his absolute best here, is a good ghost sent to warn them. Paxcow tells Ellie that Lewis is about to do something really bad. Ellie says that Paxcow was with Lewis in his final moments, but it's just not clicking for Rachel. See, she knows of Paxcow, but she doesn't realize it yet. Ellie begs her mom to call home and make sure that Lewis is okay. As Rachel leaves the room, she thinks aloud about where she knows the name Paxcow. Luckily, Pascal appears to her and pronounces his name correctly, which, like, girl, you didn't put two and friggin' two together, but whatever. Once she realizes Ellie is talking about Victor Pascal, who Lewis clearly told her about, because that's a pretty traumatic first day at work, and that there's no way Ellie would have known about him without it actually being a true vision, she bolts to the phone. She calls Lewis, but of course, there's no answer. He's going bananas in the graveyard. So, of course, she calls Judd the troublemaker. She asks Judd if Lewis is with him, and he replies no, knowing exactly what Lewis is up to. She tells Judd she's coming home. He tries to stop her, but it's no use. She hangs up the phone and sets off to make her way back to Maine. Judd decides he's going to wait outside for Lewis while he maniacally digs up his son, hoping he'll catch Lewis before he makes his way down the path to the Micmac grounds. But, alas, Judd passes out on the porch before he can catch Lewis and stop him. Literally, thanks for nothing, Judd. We cut to Rachel, who has made it back to Maine and is racing home in her rental car. She blows a tire out and swerves off the side of the road. Pascal appears and tries to tell her that this is a sign to stop. It's not safe for her to go home anymore. Not with what Lewis has done. But, you know, no one listens to poor Pascal. She winds up having to hitchhike in a truck that, of course, looks just like the one that killed Gage. And probably Church. And, well, probably Pascal, too. And I don't know, like, hitchhiking in general just does not seem okay, but hitchhiking in the 70s, 80s, I just feel like that was a one-way ticket to Murderville. So, after Lewis does his dirty work at the Micmac grounds, he heads home for some R&R, because being unhinged sure does take a lot out of you. While McDreamy is getting his beauty sleep, Gage returns. He makes his way into the house, up the stairs, and steals a scalpel out of Lewis's medical bag. He then trots on over to Judd's house, slamming the screen door on his porch and stirring him awake for a twisted game of hide and seek. Judd sees the tiny tot's footprints leading inside. He moves through the house, searching for Gage, switchblade in tow. He reaches his bedroom, and he knows he's hiding under the bed. When he kneels down and attempts to pull back the cover, Church distracts him. Gage then takes the scalpel and cuts right through his Achilles tendon, which is so fucked. Judd grabs his ankle and sits up shocked at what happened. He opens his mouth to scream, and Gage takes the scalpel and slices his mouth horizontally like some kind of fucked up paper cut. Judd falls over, choking on his own blood, and Gage does a mean, vampire-esque chomp down on his neck and rips his throat out. And that's the end of Judd the Troublemaker. Rachel finally makes it home, but when she steps off the truck, she gets distracted by both Zelda and Gage's voice coming from Judd's house. She walks through the house, calling for Judd. She hears moans coming from upstairs and begins to follow the sound. She hears Zelda calling her name from the bedroom. She opens the door and finds Zelda crouched in the corner. Zelda tells her she's finally come back for her. She's going to twist her back like her so she can never get out of bed again. Zelda rushes up to her, cackling. Rachel gets completely overwhelmed and hides her face. The cackles eventually fade and transition into Gage's laugh. Rachel opens her eyes and cries at the sight of him, who still has the scalpel in his hand. Hello? But she bends down to embrace him and winds up getting stabbed to death. Lewis wakes in the morning to find Gage's muddy little footprints in his room. He then sees his medical bag on the floor, opened, and notices his scalpel's missing. He makes his way downstairs and gets a phone call from Rachel's father, Erwin. He says Ellie wants to talk to Rachel because she had a premonition that Rachel was dead. Lewis is alarmed because Rachel never made it home. That, coupled with Gage's muddy footprints, unfortunately tells Lewis everything he needs to know. He tries to get Lewis to put her on the phone, but clearly she's across the street, totally dead AF, so she can't. Lewis tells Erwin she's asleep, but he says too bad, wake her up, and he just basically hangs up on him. The phone rings again, and Lewis picks it up all annoyed, thinking it's Erwin, but it's Gage. Gage tells Lewis that he wants to play with him. First he played with Judd, then he played with Rachel, and they had an awful good time. So Lewis makes his way over to Judd's, armed with some kind of drug drawn into a syringe that we're left to assume is strong enough to kill or heavily sedate. And I'm always very disturbed by the next scene. Lewis sees Church in front of Judd's house and lures him over with a stake. He then grabs him and injects him with the medication. And it just looks real rough and brutal on this poor cat. But from what I could find, all actions involving the cat, including the scene where Lewis euthanizes or sedates him, were filmed under the supervision of a vet and an animal cruelty association. Lewis makes his way through the house, following Gage's creepy-ass little laugh. He enters Judd's bedroom and finds his body sticking out from under the bed. Thoroughly scared, he stumbles back into the hall. And then he finds Rachel. And by find, I mean teeny tiny Gage, who was all but two in the film, but now with his supremely newly acquired zombie strength and fine motor skills, has hung her from a rope and dropped her from the opening to the attic in the ceiling. Lewis falls to the floor in horror and spots Gage laughing, who then dive bombs, like literally flies through the air and attacks Lewis. They fight and roll around on the floor. Gage actually stabs him multiple times, but eventually Lewis is able to stab Gage with the syringe he brought and knock him out. McDreamy decides he's going to do what Judd did to the Baderman house. He's going to burn it down, but not before removing Rachel's body and, you guessed it, burying her in the goddamn Micmac burial ground. Pascal tries one more time to stop him, but Lewis is too far gone. Lewis argues that he waited too long to try and resurrect Gage, but since Rachel just died, it's totally gonna work. But we know that's not the case. Rachel comes back, She makes her way home. Lewis stands to greet her. They make out, which is totally gross because half her face is mauled off and bleeding. And while they're kissing, she reaches for a butcher's knife and kills the shit out of Lewis. Okay, so some fun facts about the film. And you guys know if there's two things I love about movie breakdowns, it's fun facts and symbolism. So, the menacing red semi-truck wreaking havoc in the film was a 1988 Peterbilt 378 specifically built for the film. Onto the music. So the score is great. Creepy as fuck, an eerie piano melody coupled with a haunting children's choir. Can't beat it. But the two songs in the film featured by the Ramones, Sheena is a punk rocker, which is playing when Gage dies, and the second, aptly titled Pet Cemetery at the closing credits, really take the cake. If you're a horror fan, I don't know how you can hear Sheena is a punk rocker and not think of this movie. King was a big fan of the Ramones, and he already had Sheena written into the novel. Regarding the latter, the next events as to how King got the Ramones to do a song for the film are a little muddy and inconsistent. There are reports from the Ramones camp that say one thing, to which King denies. So, let's leave it at the facts. King was a huge Ramones fan. He wanted them featured in the movie. And the Ramones made one of my favorite songs for a film. They even mentioned someone named Victor, which we can only assume is a nod to Victor Pascal in both the second and third verse. Another little fun fact, the Pet Cemetery video was shot in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in New York, which is just a short drive away from the Hartsdale Pet Cemetery. I love a full circle moment. So, when I said that this movie totally traumatized me and made me very uncomfortable, I meant it. But I'm not the only one who shared that sentiment. Stephen King himself was pretty put off by what he created. Of the book, King said, "I just had the greatest time writing the book until I was done with it. I read it over and I said to myself, this is awful. This is really fucking terrible." King didn't express this in terms of the caliber of the writing. He was appalled by the subject matter. So much so that he wrote the novel in 1979 and promptly tucked it away, hoping to never look at it again. But fate had other plans. Essentially, if not for King wanting to get out of his publishing contract because he was getting screwed, we may never have gotten Pet Cemetery. He offered up the company one more novel in exchange for dissolving his contract, and in 1983, Doubleday Publishing printed Pet Cemetery. The movie rights were sold a year later, with King signing on to write the screenplay. King felt that if he had a hand in the script, maybe he could improve upon it in some way or work through the trauma of what he had written in the novel, but the script stayed very close to the book, and it's just as fucked. The film was originally set to be directed by none other than George Romero, but due to scheduling conflicts, he had to back out. It's interesting to note that Stephen King actually wasn't the biggest fan of how Lambert's film turned out. Although it followed closely to the novel, King had issues with the performances of Dale Midkiff and Denise Crosby, aka Rachel Creed and Doc McDreamy. He felt that they both lacked depth and warmth, even going as far as to call McDreamy's performance stiff. King felt they didn't depict the connection and bond he had communicated in his novel, and what one might expect to see from a family going through not just the loss of a child, but one caught in the midst of this supernatural activity. And as the author of both the novel and the screenplay, that's his right to feel that way. But as a viewer, I don't know, I kind of disagree. I think it completely makes sense to see a coldness and a disconnect between McDreamy and Rachel. I mean, he's clearly not accepted by her family. They've just moved across the country, essentially to a new and low-key creepy-as-fuck destination. They're alienated, things are crumbling around them, their child dies, their only companions are a housekeeper who commits suicide and Judd the fucking troublemaker. I don't know, sorry, the last thing I would have wanted to see was two people walking around unaffected or full of warmth. To me, to see them triggered and deteriorating, fragmenting off from one another seems totally realistic. Do some people come together in tough times and get stronger? Sure. But can some relationships be broken by it? Yeah, also sure. I'm not saying anyone's performance was Oscar-worthy here, but I appreciated how gloomy and empty and in pain the characters looked. And the way they handled both of these situations differently, especially when you take into consideration how each of them handled death at the start and end of the film. Lewis, whether his profession or past cultivated this mindset, he had more of a, quote, realistic sensibility about death. Lewis wasn't running away from it. He was okay confronting death on a daily basis, but also knew that confrontation meant consequences. But I definitely don't think he ever realized how grave, pun intended, they actually might be in the end. When Lewis processed things, he isolated. He completely went inward and eventually went batshit fucking crazy. He pulled away from everyone. His family, Judd, Pascal. Nobody listened to my precious Pascal. Like people, when a sassy and sarcastic ghost appears to you and warns you, you listen. But back to McDreamy, he just regressed. There was no redemption, no growth. Lewis did not triumph. And unfortunately, not really allowing the themes of grief and death and guilt to permeate and penetrate the script can make their decisions and reactions read as one-dimensional. Now, Rachel, on the other hand, I think there's something to be said for her story arc. I think in the beginning, we can kind of view her emotional capacity and capabilities as that of a little girl. She seems fragile and weak. Clearly, based on what Rachel has been through with watching her sister die and having to be her caretaker, it's clear that she was traumatized and naturally she remained frozen at a younger age. Her relationship with her parents seems okay now, but we don't know what it was truly like then. We don't know if she feels resentment. We don't know. But based on her reactions to things in the beginning of the film, like the pet cemetery, Lewis talking about death with Ellie, making him reassure her that when Church gets his nuts cut, he's going to be just fine, she doesn't feel okay with these conversations. She's not okay with mortality. Rachel does not come off as strong in the beginning. It seems like she puts a lot on Lewis, whether it's hard conversations or even just screaming at Lewis to go run after Gage when he's approaching the road. Not to be judgy, but like, I don't know, if that was me, I don't care how much further away I was, instinctively, I think not just me, but everyone would get up and run. She just seems like she looks to Lewis, like not just as a partner, but as a caretaker. But when tragedy happens, she does want to get her family out of there. She turns to her family for comfort. She tries to take Lewis with them. And when it comes to heading back home, she's not going to let anything get in her way. I mean, she hops in an 18-wheeler with a random trucker. Bold move. She's definitely braver than when the film started, but unfortunately, she pays the price for it. I think, unfortunately, the themes of grief and death and how we process it or avoid it altogether that are gestured throughout the film don't exactly get showcased enough for them to be one of the main characters like they should be. I think it would have been better if we just extended the film's runtime to really flesh out each character's inner monologue or external expression of grief. While I think most people, and just people who watch horror movies in general, are smart enough to try and see the nuance of things, for some, I feel like they might view this film superficially, like, well, that's stupid, why the fuck did he do that, or why the fuck are they acting like that? And kind of write it off, instead of viewing actions and conversations through the lens of grief and the fear of one's own mortality or someone else's. And how even when you think you have a stance on the subject matter, you never know how you'll act when something so tragic hits close to home. All right, well, that wraps up this week's second episode. If you're digging the podcast, get it, digging, like grave digging, I'll stop. Please leave a 5-star rating or a review. It really helps the show grow. Thanks so much for joining me. I'll see you next time, and stay spooky, friends.